The headlines: U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for the 152nd day, with the death toll surpassing 30,700, mostly women and children. The Hamas resistance movement asserts that any ceasefire agreement must effectively prevent all kinds of Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. Former U.S. President Donald Trump secures victories across 13 states in Republican primaries on Super Tuesday, further strengthening his position in the race for the White House. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour is Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip enters its 152nd day. More civilians fall victim to the regime's airstrikes on the besieged territory over the past 24 hours. An Israeli bombing on the Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City left two Palestinians dead and several more injured. The city has witnessed another attack on the people waiting for aid, resulting in the injury of several of them. In central Gaza, six civilians, including a journalist working for Al-Aqsa TV, were killed in the attacks on homes in Deir al-Bala. To the south, 25 bodies have been recovered from under the rubble in different areas of the city of Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, the World Food Program reported that the Israeli army denied the entry of an aid convoy to famine-stricken northern Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since early October has now surpassed 30,700, with a majority of them being women and children. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has held an extraordinary foreign ministerial meeting in the Saudi city of Jeddah to discuss the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Gaza was the focus of the talks, with a final OIC statement calling for an immediate and unconditional end to the deadly Israeli aggression against the besieged territory.
The OIC calls for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire and cessation of the all-out aggression against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, the provision of unimpeded and adequate humanitarian, medical and relief aid, the provision of water and electricity, and the opening of humanitarian corridors to deliver urgent aid to the Gaza Strip.
The statement from the 57-member bloc also warned about the dangerous consequences of continuing Israeli genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza. It called on the UN Security Council to take urgent measures to stop Israeli atrocities in Gaza as well as the rest of the occupied Palestinian territories. The OIC categorically rejected any attempt to forcibly transfer the Palestinian people from their ancestral land. It said that peace can only be achieved when the Israeli occupation comes to an end.
The OIC affirms that peace, security, and stability in the region can only be achieved by ending the Israeli colonial occupation and all its illegal policies and criminal practices against the Palestinian people, and calls on all countries and international institutions to take practical steps that lead to empowering the Palestinian people with their inalienable rights, specifically their right to self-determination, independence, and return on the basis of international law and international legitimacy solutions, and to confront all the steps that undermine these rights.
The OIC also deplored some countries for claiming to be the defenders of human rights while at the same time supporting the ongoing aggression against Palestinians and granting impunity to the Israeli regime. The organization did not single out a country, but the U.S. is known for its strong political and military support to the Israeli regime since it launched a genocidal war on Gaza back in October. Tuesday's foreign ministerial meeting of the OIC was held at the request of Iran and several other members. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the United States is piling up pressure on the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, to accept a temporary ceasefire with Israel. This is yet another attempt by Washington to back the regime after providing it with weapons and money to launch this genocidal war on the Gaza Strip.
The hostage deal is in the hands of Hamas right now. Okay. Because they've been an offer, rational offer. The Israelis have agreed to it, and waiting to see what the Hamas does.
Biden also claimed that the Tel Aviv regime has presented a rational offer on the establishment of a ceasefire. He also talked about Israeli captives held in Gaza, but failed to mention thousands of Palestinians languishing in the regime's jails for months and years without trial or charges. The U.S. president made the remarks as Egyptian and Qatari mediators are trying to find ways to hammer out a deal before the holy month of Ramadan. The United States has already vetoed three U.N. resolutions on the Gaza ceasefire and supplied Tel Aviv with military and financial support for the Gaza war. Meanwhile, Hamas underlined that the security of Palestinians will not be ensured unless a permanent ceasefire takes hold.
In the past 2 days, Hamas presented its position on the proposal by Qatari and Egyptian mediators at the end of last week. We reaffirmed our conditions for a ceasefire, a full pullout from the Gaza Strip, the return of the displaced to the areas they left, providing adequate relief and medical aid, and launching the reconstruction process.
Hamdan called for complete pullout of Israeli troops from Gaza and unimpeded delivery of aid to Palestinians. Israel is reportedly against the withdrawal of its forces and the return of Palestinian refugees to the northern part of the Strip as part of a week-long humanitarian ceasefire brokered by Qatar and Egypt. Fighting was paused and humanitarian aid was allowed into Gaza. Back in December, it also saw an exchange of 240 Palestinian abductees with 105 Israeli captives. Hamas has said time and again that any prisoner exchange deal is out of question unless its conditions for a ceasefire are met. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Wakim, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, also from Saidiya, Morocco. We have political commentator Kevin Barrett. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Wakim. We're listening to the comments by U.S. President Joe Biden, who claims that the Israelis have put forth a rational offer. I want to get your thoughts on that. How do you read into those comments by the U.S. president? And the main question here is, can the Israelis even be trusted in such a situation?
Well, of course, Biden is supporting Israel ever since it launched its aggression against Gaza. And he's supporting also all political stances and initiatives. He wants Israel to be victorious in this aggression against the resistance in the Gaza Strip. And that's why he is endorsing all conditions and prerequisites for such an objective to be achieved. This is how we can understand Biden's comments. In this regard, of course, Israel cannot be trusted, and throughout the Arab-Israeli struggle, it was only checked by power and by force, not by any negotiations or any agreement. So that's why I believe that these conditions that are put on the table by Israel are not acceptable to the resistance in Gaza. And this will drag on the conflict in the Gaza Strip, leading to more and more civilians to get killed by the Israeli army.
Mr. Kevin Barrett, I want to get your thoughts as well. Do you agree with our guest in Beirut that these conditions that are being putting forth by the Israelis in Washington are not acceptable? Why is that? And do you also see that Washington and the Tel Aviv regime, they just keep kicking the ball down further down the field?
Yeah, I think he's right. That is that the Israelis are looking for a kind of a so-called temporary ceasefire, which would allow for all of their hostages to be released. And then, after that ceasefire is over, they would be free to continue committing genocide and pulverizing the Gaza without any kind of restraint. Obviously, that's a non-starter. The only way that the Palestinian resistance can reasonably be expected to release all the Israelis in its custody is if there's going to be a permanent ceasefire, not a temporary one. That's the sticking point here, it seems. And the Americans, unfortunately, are seeking an Israeli victory. They are on the side of the Zionists. Biden's administration is surrounded by Zionists, and they don't want to see their side lose. They also have political problems, though, because Biden will very likely lose the next presidential election if there hasn't been some kind of durable peace. Now, what he would like to see, I suppose, would be some sort of imaginary Israeli victory. But there's no such thing. That can't happen. There's no prospective path to the Israelis defeating Hamas and getting their people back alive. It can't. That's not going to happen. But in an Israeli victory scenario. But they have these delusions. Netanyahu does, because if all the other alternatives involve Netanyahu leaving power and very likely entering prison, and then the Americans are really just hostages of the Zionists, and so they entertain these lunatic fantasies. Ultimately, the Americans are going to have to put pressure on the Zionists to accept some kind of permanent cessation to this genocide. That's the only reasonable way this can end, and that's the only way that Biden can preserve his chances of being reelected.
All right, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Thanks to my guest, Professor Jamal Wakim, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and also political commentator Kevin Barrett, joining us from Saidia, Morocco. Welcome back. Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids across the occupied West Bank cities, abducting several Palestinians. Earlier, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, updated us on Israeli raids that are taking place almost on a daily basis.
The Israelis are arresting people from all walks of life, including women and children, and even Palestinian former prisoners who had been recently released in the latest swap deal that was accepted between the resistance groups and Israel. And at the same time, the Israelis are detaining former prisoners. This morning, the Israelis raided Tulkarem. They raided also Bitonia, Al-Khalil, the village of Kufra'in near Ramallah, Qalqilia, Tulkarem, and Bethlehem. According to the recent statistics from the Palestinian Prisoners Commission, 15 Palestinians had been detained this morning, and the number could be even more than 15. And this means the number of Palestinians who had been detained since the 7th of October is today over 7,430 Palestinians. The Israelis continue to claim that the main aim of the non-stop Israeli operations across the occupied West Bank is in order to prevent people from being engaged in any form of resistance. Even if these are peaceful demonstrations, different forms of activity.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it has precisely targeted a building in the Israeli settlement of Avivim with appropriate weapons inflicting significant damage to it. Hezbollah says the attack was in retaliation for Israel's recent deadly aggression against southern Lebanon. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to hear more. Mariam, what do you have to share with us?
Well, that retaliation, one of the several rounds of retaliation for Hezbollah. Hezbollah yesterday seemed to have sent one of the largest, perhaps the largest, rocket salvo towards the Israeli settlement since the beginning of the war. And here we're talking about dozens of rockets that targeted the Kfar Blum settlement. And that came right after the Israelis launched an aggression in the town of Hula, where three civilians were killed. A woman and her husband and son were killed in that shelling specifically. And so therefore, after that, Hezbollah retaliated directly by this salvo of rockets towards Kfar Blum. But in addition to that, they also targeted and retaliated for the shelling in the towns of Bint Jbeil, and we also had another attack in the town of Dibin, where three civilians were also wounded. And Hezbollah targeted not only a settlement in Avivim, but also in Kiryat Shmona, where they say they also destroyed that residence as well. Now, Hezbollah had also launched several significant operations yesterday. It was a day basically compact with very important operations. They targeted a force, an Israeli force that was in its armored vehicles and in the town of, in the settlement, in the area of Birka Tricia. And the heavy, the shelling or the rocket fires by Hezbollah was so heavy to the extent that the fire continued in that site and it was in flames for several hours. People could see it. Also, eyewitnesses saw it from afar and saw how that barracks, specifically in surrounding that area, it was in flames and the fires continued to be unextinguished. We also had several areas where we had the Eastern Division, 769. That too was targeted by Hezbollah with rocket fire. That was also in the Kiryat Shmon area, in addition to Kfar Blum as well. Like we said, we also had another Merkava tank that was, as Hezbollah said, targeted directly, and it was in Natua. And they also mentioned, when Hezbollah is very specific in their statements, not to mention if they did not see any casualties, they said that there were definitely casualties, either killed or wounded soldiers in that Merkava tank that fell as a result of that operation alone. Specifically, Hezbollah has also released some numbers, actually, and we're talking about 150 days since the beginning of the war. They say there's at least 2,000 Israeli soldiers either killed or wounded as a result of the continuous operations by Hezbollah. There's also huge numbers of rockets that were fired. They talk about those numbers. We're talking about here at least 5 kilometers from the border in the Galilee that have been completely evacuated. You have also Hezbollah's rocket fire reaching more than 23 kilometers within those settlements and that area. You have 43 settlements that were evacuated, and at least 230,000 settlers of the Israelis have been evacuated and have been displaced from that area since the beginning of the confrontations. You have also, Hezbollah has mentioned that they have targeted and perhaps destroyed some 68 vehicles, 38 command centers, and 283 fortifications. And of course, they're in addition to the espionage devices that they have also destroyed, the technological hardware for the Israelis. We're talking about some 300 in addition to 570 residents or settlements that are built in those settlement areas that were destroyed by Hezbollah. So you have very significant numbers for that were issued by Hezbollah. Of course, Hezbollah has said 2,000 Israeli soldiers have been killed or wounded, since they cannot really verify how many were killed. But they have also said that any number that is given by the Israeli army is inaccurate, and it is usually much more than what it is. Of course, the Israelis continue their shelling, and we are seeing heavy shelling in the towns, like I said, of Dabin, and we have new shelling in the area of Kfar Kila as well. And it seems the confrontation is getting more intensified, just perhaps maybe hours, maybe days of a possible truce that could also be implemented here in Lebanon as well.
Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. On to the United States, where it was rather a joyous occasion for former President Donald Trump, who's increased his lead further on Super Tuesday. This is a day when the outcome of Democratic and Republican primaries in 15 states and one territory typically shapes the race for the White House. Addressing his supporters in Florida, Trump hailed his wins as unprecedented.
Thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one. And they tell me, the pundits and otherwise, that there's never been one like this. There's never been anything so conclusive. This was an amazing night, an amazing day. It's been an incredible period of time in our country's history. It's been sad in so many ways, but I think it's going to be inspiring because we're going to do something that, frankly, nobody's been able to do for a long time.
Trump's sole Republican challenger, Nikki Haley, is far behind, as she's won only in Vermont. Trump has won at least 890 delegates to date, while Haley has secured fewer than 70. That despite the former president is facing a number of lawsuits in the Democratic camp. Incumbent President Joe Biden is cruising toward nomination as he swept in all 15 states on Super Tuesday. Biden remains a frontrunner for Democrats as he faces no real challenger within the party. He gears up for a likely rematch with Trump in November. Meanwhile, Biden said in a statement that a second Trump's term would be a return to, quote, chaos, division, and darkness. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants have made their final arguments to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia racketeering case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be removed from the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants is now up to the Fulton County judge overseeing the matter, who said he would make a decision within the next 2 weeks. At a three-hour proceeding before Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, attorneys for each side presented legal arguments for and against disqualifying Fannie Willis from the case over her romantic relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. It capped a series of extraordinary hearings following allegations from Michael Roman, a Republican operative charged along with Donald Trump, that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade had an improper romantic relationship and that the district attorney financially benefited from this. Donald Trump and seven others joined Roman's effort to disqualify Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade and her office from prosecuting the racketeering case against them and are seeking to have the charges against them dismissed. Prosecutors and defense attorneys gathered in Atlanta courtroom to present their closing arguments to Judge Scott McAfee. Nathan Wade attended the hearing while Fannie Willis sat at the prosecution's table to watch Adam Abate, who works in her office, give his presentation. The judge did not issue a decision from the bench, saying he has several legal issues to sort through and factual determinations to make before issuing a ruling. If this court allows this kind of behavior to go on and allows district attorneys across the state by its order to engage in these kinds of activities, the entire public confidence in the system will be shot and the integrity of the system will be undermined, said John Merchant, a defense attorney representing Michael Roman, who opened the arguments for the defendants. Adam Abate said there had been absolutely no evidence that the district attorney has benefited at all or would benefit in the future from the prosecution of the case. Michael Roman claimed that the relationship between Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis began before she hired him as special prosecutor in the case against Donald Trump in early November 2021. The two admitted in a court filing that they did have a personal relationship but said it started in 2022. Both Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade testified during evidentiary hearings last month and divulged personal details about their relationship, financial affairs and travels to places like Napa Valley, Belize and Aruba. During several hours on the witness stand, Fannie Willis forcefully defended herself from accusations she acted improperly and financially benefited from Nathan Wade's hiring. Defense attorneys claimed that Nathan Wade paid for hotel rooms, cruises and getaways, though both prosecutors said they split the costs associated with their travels. Fannie Willis said she reimbursed Nathan Wade in cash. To demonstrate that Fannie Willis typically used cash to cover expenses, on Tuesday, prosecutors filed an affidavit from Stan Brody, who worked at a winery in Napa that she and Wade visited last year. Brody asserted that Fannie Willis paid $400 in cash. The district attorney had accused Ashley Merchant, Michael Roman's attorney, of spreading lies and salacious rumors. "You've been intrusive into people's personal lives," Fannie Willis said during her testimony on 16th of February. "You're confused. You think I'm on trial here. These people are on trial for trying to steal an election in 2020. I'm certainly not on trial, no matter how hard you try to put me on trial." CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's attorneys on Friday, 1st of March, sought to delay one of his criminal trials until after the November election and disqualified the district attorney prosecuting another case against the former president in a split screen that underscored how all of Donald Trump's criminal cases can't help but overlap. In Florida, Trump's attorneys told Judge Eileen Cannon his Mar-a-Lago classified documents case should wait until after the 2024 presidential election. At roughly the same time in Georgia, attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants made their final argument to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in the Georgia racketeering case over her relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Neither judge made the decision on Friday, 1st of March, but both hearings could have a significant impact on when or whether Donald Trump will face trial in each of these two cases. Trump's legal calendar remains a jumble of pre-trial legal motions, with three of the four trials still in limbo. In addition to Florida and Georgia, Special Counsel Jack Smith's election subversion case in Washington remains on hold, with the Supreme Court set to hear arguments on Donald Trump's presidential immunity claims next month. The only case that appears set is Donald Trump's New York criminal trial. That will begin on 25th of March, which Trump's attorney said was a firm date in court on Friday, 1st of March. Meanwhile, a parade of defense attorneys in the Fulton County racketeering case argued that Fannie Willis should be disqualified, stating that she lied about her relationship with Nathan Wade and received benefits from him in the form of trips. Friday's hearing marked the final arguments in the case before Judge Scott McAfee rules on whether to disqualify Fannie Willis after several weeks of testimony that included Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis both taking the stand. The Washington Post has also covered the same story. The judge in the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his allies said on Friday, 1st of March, He plans to issue a decision within 2 weeks on whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be disqualified and charges dismissed because of her romance and international travel with lead prosecutor Nathan Wade. Over more than 3 hours of closing arguments on Friday, 1st of March, prosecutors and defense lawyers presented two starkly opposing views on whether Fannie Willis's office should be removed from the case. Defense lawyers argued that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade created a conflict of interest by not disclosing their relationship or travel expenditures. The prosecution argued that the defense never proved their central allegations that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade began dating before she hired him in November of 2021, and that she allowed him to pay for travel that they shared. The salacious accusations have taken the Georgia case far off course since they emerged in a January pleading from one of Donald Trump's co-defendants, delaying proceedings for weeks and now threatening to fully derail the prosecution as the spotlight turns to Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee as he decides what to do. The controversy has attracted a national audience because of its potential impact on the 2024 presidential election, with fresh uncertainty on whether a trial will begin before November and what would happen to the case overall if Donald Trump is elected the President of the United States. It is the second of 4 ongoing prosecutions against Trump facing delays against the backdrop of the fall election. The federal election interference case in Washington is awaiting an April Supreme Court review of a claim of immunity.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
For 5 months, the Israeli regime has waged what many call a holocaust against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Still, the occupation regime has not been able to achieve any of its stated goals. Palestinian fighters have proved quite resilient and capable of fighting off the enemy. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to discuss the cost of the genocidal war that the Tel Aviv regime has waged against the Palestinians. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this edition. Charlotte Gates, with the International Coordinator of the Summit on Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, is also joining us from Manchester. Now, beginning with Vancouver, Charlotte, there are different aspects to what has cost the Israeli regime in different ways, you know, internal divisions, you know, their standing and maybe popularity or notoriety at the world stage on the diplomatic front. There are many aspects we're going to discuss and explore one by one. So let's begin with this division thing that we see, obviously, among the Israeli officials. We had several Israeli cabinet ministers making objections against the regime's military chief, saying that the Israeli occupation force ground operation in Gaza has not been effective, it's been too slow. And the funny thing is that these are the very same people who were opposed to the operation, actually the ground invasion, in the very early days of the war.
Well, one thing that we always see
be among for Zionist politicians is their willingness to kill Palestinians, occupy Palestinian land, torture Palestinian prisoners. And in fact, these are regularly campaign points in Zionist elections. But what we're also seeing are these fundamental contradictions that are part of this settler colonial project, because this project is having a difficult time maintaining itself. What actually the 7th of October showed to the Zionist regime and to the world was that it kind of confirmed once and for all that this is going to be a temporary project in the region. No matter how much it throws its billions upon billions of dollars of weaponry upon civilians and massacres civilians, target schools and hospitals and mosques and churches and residential buildings, it is never going to be able to preserve itself in Palestine and in the region simply by carrying out the mass slaughter of civilians on an industrial scale. And so we're also seeing an inconvenience for the United States and its imperialist backers that are facing increased domestic opposition, a mass protest movement, refusals to vote for Joe Biden and his colleagues so long as they remain complicit in the genocide. And so we're seeing those contradictions also within the U.S. imperialist camp also playing out inside the Zionist regime. It's also very clear that Netanyahu very specifically is extending this war for as long as possible, extending the genocide for as long as possible, refusing to withdraw, refusing to stop bombing, refusing a ceasefire, simply in order to perpetuate his own impunity. Netanyahu has very good reason to be concerned, not only that he's going to be prosecuted for corruption, but that he and his top officials are going to be prosecuted for their utter failure on the 7th of October. And so he's attempting to prolong his own political career, even though the future of the Zionist project itself might be on the line.
Okay. Now, Ambassador Ford, on the diplomatic front, we have Chile and several other South American countries, Honduras, Colombia, Belize, Brazil. They have all recalled their ambassadors. You know, 9 or 10 countries, as I was just searching for this, they have either severed their relations with the Tel Aviv regime or they've at least summoned their envoys. So do you expect this same process to continue?
No, not really. If somebody hasn't cut relations after 5 months of this horror, I don't think they're going to do so now. And in any case, it's not clear that cutting relations is achieving very much. I mean, I'm glad it's happening. It's the right moral thing to do, but if we're honest, we have to say that it's not affecting Israeli behavior. They can absorb this kind of punishment. They you see, Israel plays to a gallery of one, Washington, or more precisely, U.S. Congress. They are not worried about anything that anybody else does because they control the U.S. Congress and nothing else matters.
But at least it shows, Ambassador, do you agree that Israel is losing its standing on the international front? Countries are just getting away, you know, keeping distance from the regime.
Well, I think Washington itself is more worried about the loss to its own international standing. America's moral standing in the world is about at floor level after the unlimited support they have given to massacres in Gaza. And I think the Americans are sincerely concerned about their loss of reputation and prestige. So far, this hasn't hurt them enough to make them stop arms deliveries to Israel. The Americans will do anything except what is really necessary. That is to cut the arms deliveries. This would force Israel in 24 hours to withdraw. But it's not happening, and it's not likely to happen.
All right. Now, speaking of the U.S., Charlotte, there are some analysts arguing that the U.S. administration has become fed up and maybe frustrated with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. So they cite this the trip by Benny Gantz, main political rival of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He is there in Washington, and U.S. officials have accepted to meet him. And what does this trip signal?
Well, the one thing to note about Gantz is that while he is a political rival of Netanyahu, he is also a member of the war cabinet who is currently carrying out this genocide. Mm-hmm. So while he's a political rival of Netanyahu, he's no less of a war criminal and a genocidaire than Netanyahu is. And so it's always really important to keep that at the forefront, because the idea is somehow to portray it to the public in the United States and internationally that Gantz is somehow a kinder, gentler form of Zionist colonizer, but he is at the heart of the war council carrying out the genocide right now. There's certainly been a long history of disputes and disagreements personally and on a tactical level between the U.S. administration and Netanyahu, Netanyahu favoring, for example, in the U.S. elections, Biden's rival, Donald Trump. And so there are some of these kinds of political considerations. But what has always guided this alignment between U.S. imperialism and Zionism is the role that the Zionist regime plays for the United States in the region, you know, as kind of, as they say, a giant aircraft carrier for the United States, placed in the heart of Palestine and carrying out that mission through an ongoing genocide. So the United States is interested in what can continue to keep the Zionist entity alive and keep its own imperial domination of the region alive, especially when the powers and forces of resistance in the region have been growing so significantly, and as we're seeing in Yemen and as we're seeing elsewhere in the region as well. But one of the other things that the U.S. is trying to do and that U.S. officials are trying to do is they're trying to signal to the Democratic Party's electoral base in the United States, which is decidedly unenthusiastic and, in fact, outraged by, in many cases, this ongoing supply of weaponry to the Zionist regime and its genocide, and say that, no, we're trying to do something because Biden is expressing mild concern about Netanyahu or meeting with Benny Gantz, who, again, is a co-perpetrator of this genocide. In order to kind of assuage their domestic political base as well as to try to repair their image internationally, but they're failing to do so because the only thing that they need to do is just stop sending them weapons. If they're interested in stopping this, that's all they need to do, and they absolutely refuse to do that.
Right. Now, Peter, let's look at the financial and monetary aspect of this. The cost of waging this deadly war for the Tel Aviv regime, I read somewhere, it's rose to almost $60 billion last month. And the government spending is soaring in order to be able to pay for all those bombs and bullets while revenues are dropping. So how badly is the Israeli economy being impacted by this war?
Well, again, we come back to Washington, and it appears that Washington will always bail out the Israeli economy if it gets into real trouble. And it is in real trouble. Its debt has been downgraded by Moody's, the ratings agency. The shekel is bumping along the bottom at 15-year lows. The construction industry has been decimated because they can't use Palestinian workers anymore. Exports are down at an annualized rate of about 40%. They're nearly halved. Investment has almost totally collapsed. So the economy, and they have hundreds of thousands, about 200,000 people who've been displaced in the north and the south. But the Israeli economy seems able to sustain this level of punishment. And as I said at the beginning, at the end of the day, they know they can count on billions coming from the U.S. Congress, which are already on the way.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, that's a question I was just going to ask Charlotte. You know, Israeli tax office announcing that a loss is incurred by the Gaza war is six times greater than those of the 33-day war against Lebanon in 2006. And there have been 500,000 requests filed at the Israeli judiciary asking for war reparations and damages. So this can slow down catering for the cost of the Israeli wartime, you know, war machine, can't it? Can Tel Aviv stomach all this single-handedly? Like Ambassador Ford said, the U.S. is always there. But what about Israel on its own?
Well, the problem is that Israel is not on its own. It's never been on its own. It's always been part and parcel of the imperialist project in the region. It serves essentially as an arm of the United States. And that is part of the problem. At the same time, it is clear that the resistance is imposing a real cost upon the Zionist project. I mean, and it's making it unsustainable. That's a reality. I mean, there's a reason why on October 7th and the day after, we saw flights to, if they weren't shut down, flights to get out of the Zionist project absolutely packed, because it's a fundamentally unsustainable settler colonial project that can only be maintained through this ongoing massacres, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, up to and including the current ongoing crime of genocide. The Israeli economy essentially is an artificially propped up structure that's constantly being boosted as a so-called startup nation. But in reality, that only exists as a kind of artificially boosted economic force to represent the imperial core in the heart of the Arab nation and the heart of the broader region, none of which has anything to do with this entity that is there. And so this artificial economy is facing severe contradictions, just like we're seeing elsewhere in the world. I mean, look at the effect on the European economy of the U.S.'s promotion of war in Ukraine. The U.S.'s allies are facing significant economic crises as a result of the U.S.'s pursuit of its specific imperial ends. And right now, the U.S. is willing to continue to swallow these costs for the Zionist regime. However, I think it's increasingly clear that the people of the United States are not willing to swallow these costs and are not willing to accept that they are the arms provider for a genocidal settler colonial project in the region.
Yeah, you mentioned people. I'm going to ask Ambassador Ford about Israeli people who are standing against the decisions of their cabinet. The streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities, you know, have turned into battlegrounds between leftists and rightists. And then we also have among the Knesset members, they're trying to gain more share of the power and wealth. Some people want Netanyahu to step down and stand trial. Some others don't. So where could these divisions and protests within the Israeli cabinet and also within the ranks of the people end up in?
Well, Netanyahu is certainly under a lot of domestic pressure, but it focuses on the hostages. The great opinion polls show that the great majority of the Israeli public, something like 60-70%, fully support what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza, and another 10-20% think he's not doing enough in terms of killing, maiming, and obliterating Gaza. The Israelis don't see on their televisions or their social media what's going on in Gaza. They don't want to know. They don't want to see. Although he's under some pressure from these street protests, all he has to do is say, well, we'll, the only way to get the hostages back is by force of arms. And he can get away with that for a long time to come. He's not feeling enough domestic pressure for it to incline him to end this conflict.
Okay. Charlotte, how do you regard this in terms of this internal division? Could these divisions and also the charges, you know, that Netanyahu is facing end up in a new storm against the Israeli cabinet, and to maybe we could see the right is pushed to isolation for quite some time?
Well, I mean, again, there is no left. There is no Zionist left. There is only just different tactics of control and domination of the Palestinian people. But what it is very clear is that the Palestinian resistance, the resistance in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Iran, that there is a regional force that is not accepting the future of Zionist domination of Palestine and the region. And that reality, which is presenting like a future that is actually visualizable, that can actually be seen coming, of a region that is free of the domination of imperialism and of Palestine, that is free of Zionism, despite the tremendous, tremendous war crimes and the horrific human toll that has been exacted by this Zionist genocide in Gaza, that is something that this project is going to face crisis after crisis after crisis until it finally collapses, and until it finally collapses under the weight and power of the resistance and of the Palestinian people and all of the forces that are fighting alongside them in the region. And I think that that's inevitable, and that what we're going to see in the future of the Zionist project is further and further contradictions, deepening contradictions, deepening crises. There is no willingness on the part of the Zionist public to fight. There's a demand to just do more and kill more Palestinians. But at the same time, there's this constant demand for relief, for support, in a way that evidences that this is not a population that is actually willing to live through the kinds of horrors that they are visiting upon the Palestinian people right now, and that they would rather give up the Zionist project in the end, many of them, and retreat to a comfortable location in the West rather than to continue this ongoing, rather than to actually face the future of the falling apart of the Zionist project and then the dismantlement of the Zionist project, which is the only way to achieve justice, liberation, and meaningful peace for all people in Palestine.
Right. Now, Peter, you mentioned the U.S. role, and as you know, the U.N. Security Council draft resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, they have all been vetoed three times, I think, by Washington. So in the last one, in the last council meeting, all U.N. Security Council members voted for a ceasefire, except the United States, and the UK abstained this time. So does this not show that the U.S. is actually is endangering its own globalist standing and is pushing itself into isolation by giving all this all-out support for the Israeli regime?
It does, but they don't care enough to change their behavior. This is by no means the first time that the U.S. has cast a veto vote on behalf of Israel. There have been scores, if not hundreds, of occasions when that has happened. And they just don't care. I mean, the fact that we keep talking about the U.N. Security Council shows how much they don't care. It's pure theater, and we delude ourselves believing that the Security Council counts for anything at all in the context of Israel and Palestine because of that U.S. Veto. It's pure theater and delusion. We should not pay any attention to the Security Council, but on the contrary, we should pay more attention to the military situation. Now, it's possible that in the weeks to come, the Israeli military will not be able to pursue their attacks on Gaza simply because of the amount of resistance that they have been meeting and which may increase. I would say that is the front to pay attention to, not right. the sector in New York.
Right. And Charlotte, one last question. You know, according to a February Gallup survey, positive views among the young adults in the U.S. vis-a-vis the Israeli regime dropped to half, from 64% last year to 38% this year. That's almost half. So that means the American people, you know, think differently from the American officials, and they have held big rallies, as you know. So Israeli image has been tarnished among many Americans. At the same time, the government is spending big bucks and taxpayer money in the war against Palestinians instead of addressing issues on the home turf. Your take on that?
I mean, I think that's absolutely true, and we're seeing it. For example, today is a major primary election day in the United States. Even though there is no major Democratic Party within the Democratic Party competitor with Biden on most of the state ballots, we're seeing a number of people voting uncommitted. We saw that in Michigan. That is an attempt to really send a message that the votes that the Democratic Party is relying on in its domestic elections are not going to be there because of the fact that, you know, as we say, genocide Joe Biden is continuing to send weapons, arms, and an unlimited blank check for ongoing genocide to the Zionist regime, as well as casting these repeated vetoes in the United Nations. The demonstrations are continuing across the United States. Just last weekend, on March 2nd, it was kind of an international day of action. And there were 50,000 people marching in New York City. There were tens of thousands in Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles. There were these massive demonstrations throughout the entire country that have not stopped for 5 months. And the fact is that many people are increasingly just actually recognizing how dangerous the United States is to the world and wanting a more significant change than just voting for a different presidential election candidate. The people that Biden is allegedly relying on to vote for him in November are increasingly people that are absolutely outraged by the fact that the United States is perpetrating genocide as we speak.
All right. On that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank my guests, Charlotte Cates in Vancouver, Peter Ford in Manchester.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.